Hi, welcome to The Womb Radio. I'm Paul Kavicki, the host, also known as Pounce, the moderator for the live audio forum. I'm speaking today with an old friend of mine, Jody Den Broder, who is a remixer. You've probably encountered those top pop hits who from your Madonna and your Britney Spears and your other famous pop stars who then get remixed into all sorts of forms, most especially for dance and club style stuff so you can shake your booty to them. And if you've ever wondered who works the magic to make that happen, to do that manipulation, you're about to meet somebody who is no longer to be called just a rising star, but he's actually doing legitimately high-end work. As we're taping this interview, Jody is working on a remix for Madonna, but he's also done remix work for Enrique Iglesias, Janet Jackson, Hilary Duff. I'm missing big ones, but and then over the past decade, Rihanna, because you did a great remix of Umbrella. But over the past decade, you've also, and that's me just talking about your independent work as yourself, but you've also been a programmer and remix engineer with other remix teams all across the country. So you've participated in remix work on in a whole lot more than that list. That's just kind of the current top of the heap stuff to talk about. Right. Welcome to the radio show.
Thanks, Paul.
Would you help clarify? So even though the audience at The Womb is musicians and engineers, but could you tell them a little bit more about what remixing actually is?
Well, what it is now is basically reproducing a record, you know. In the 80s, you know, remixing really started out as, you know, going back into the studio and just pulling it up on the board and, you know, doing a different mix. So, you know, you have more drums in the intro. But nowadays, it's you're doing a new production, basically. So you're getting primarily a vocal part, and then you're redoing all the music under it so that it's more suitable for club play.
So even though the title is mixing, truly there's a whole ton of programming or composing and programming and all that that's really involved in it, because you're mm-hmm. in the case of your current mix, you've mentioned you're just given a dry vocal, and you truly have to bring mm-hmm. all of the instrumentation to the party yourself.
You sort of have to recreate the magic all over again.
I'm going to take this thought, and now I'm going to go back in time. When I first met you, it must have been, you know, sit back in your seat and count the years with me, but it was about 15 mm-hmm. years ago, mm-hmm. something like it was in that ballpark. And one thing I can say that was similar about my current studio and yours at the time is that you had a room entirely too filled up with synthesizers and computers and all sorts mm-hmm. of gadgetry. Now, all modern remixers, yourself and truly all of them, they must use a lot of the sophisticated time stretching and other mm-hmm. software that's available, so you don't have to rely as much on hardware. But mm-hmm. just for a moment, if only for nostalgia, take me back. How would you start a process like this? Because I happen to remember you were loading samples into hardware samplers, and you were pitching things down. You were going to heroic lengths to try to achieve some of the stuff that you do now. So tell me about how the remix started when you were using hardware.
Well, this is late 90s, I guess. I was putting everything into a sampler. I was putting all the vocal parts and then triggering them. So I didn't have Pro Tools. I just was using Cubase. So, but really didn't have the software to adjust tempo. You know, that didn't work out too well back then. So,
in fact, let me also ask about this. I remember one of the first things that impressed me, that it was impressed upon me in your space, is that you also had at that time the largest library of those commercial sample CDs that I'd ever seen. You looked like you had bought everything East West had possibly had to sell or whoever.
I was looking for the perfect sound.
Is it the case now that, never mind even just all the software for for the time stretching and posing, but even the raw sounds themselves, are you finding now with all the tools available, you're more likely to just make your own instead of find it, or how do you even begin finding the sounds that you're going to bring to a remix? And one of the reasons one of the things I'm thinking in the back of my head as I ask this is your field more than some of the other music areas is really set on being current and hot. Mm-hmm. And so your old samples are probably not usable in their original form because they probably would seem too dated to the remix community. So I don't know what combination of an older library or other original creations on your part needs to be all balanced out to keep things sounding fresh. How do you do it?
Well, I'd say these days, you know, I tend to make my own sounds and not use the sampling CDs because I really find that a lot of the people that are producing these sampling CDs, you know, they're not doing high-end commercial work or, you know, and so a lot of their time goes into making these CDs, but they're not really making, you know, commercial music or club remixes or whatever. So, and, you know, I figure my ears know what I want, so.
Do you think your remixes have a particular sound? Like, if people who were very keen on remixers and that market, would they be able to pick out what a Jody Denbroder remix was just by hearing it? Would they go, oh, that's a Jody mix right there?
I've been told that people can pick it out. Yeah, definitely.
What is it? What do you think it is about your mixes that they hear? I mean, what are the qualities you think you impart on a remix?
I'm sure sonically you could tell a difference, and probably in the sound choices and I like to use a lot of effects and filtering.
I think your mixes, I think most remixes are a little more stripped down than their, mm-hmm. than the original songs that they're based on, so that there can be more emphasis put on like a vocal hook, a bass line, you know, something to groove to. So I guess you have to, one of the things I'm noticing in your remixes is you are playing through the filtering and through the effects with the empty space, so it doesn't seem dead, but it seems mm-hmm. like something is, so that there's some movement there.
Yeah, it's all catering to a dance floor, you know. So you want to do things, you want to create, you know, peaks and valleys, and you want to give people's ears a rest, you know, because music tends to be really loud in a club. So
do you think you're more dynamic than other remixers in that way?
Yeah, I would say so.
Because that might be one of the worst criticisms of that genre, that electronic genre of music mm-hmm. that I like a lot, is that if it gets too monotonous, energy level and otherwise, then it ends up being grating instead of energized and in your face. And then it just mm-hmm. becomes repetitive and grating. And you do a much better job about having the different energy levels.
Yeah. Thanks.
Sure. Tell me, one thing, I'm going to get geeky here for a second. One of the things that you talked about, and I'm going to get into technology a little bit, you immediately, we were having lunch sometime back, and as soon as I was like, well, yeah, because you got to use the side chain on the compressor and this or that way, you just seem to really perk up mm-hmm. Because you do use the side chains and compression. Can you tell me about that? Because in a lot of mixes, the relationship between the kick and the bass are pretty mm-hmm. that's important in all music, but man, in these kinds of dance remixes, I mean, that whole relationship is at a whole new extreme, and how you have mm-hmm. them relate to each other has to be pretty delicately handled. And I think you seem to have very particular opinions about how you'd use the compression and the side chain to help you achieve that. Could you tell me what that process is a little bit? I mean, I don't think that's too top secret of a.
No, it's not. I mean, it's widely used. You know, everybody doing club remixes now, you know, should know about side chaining. But, you want to keep, you know, the kick and the bass as loud as possible. And, you know, those frequencies in a club, you know, could get real muddy in the low end and, or could just steal all your headroom in a mix. So what we do is, we take the signal from the kick and, we'll sidechain it to a compressor on the bass, generally. But you can use it on keyboard parts. I use it on reverb sends. So I really get a nice pumping, you know, so it creates a movement in the song as well. But more importantly, sidechaining the bass. And so when the kick hits, your bass gets ducked down a bit, you know, as much as, you know, 10 dB.
I've read a lot of remixers who were talking about having super layered things, like having like five different kick sounds that are being played at once, some of which are being filtered in totally different ways. Like they'll combine something like three kicks, one which this I guess this reminds me of the remixer's version of the New York parallel drum technique thing, where they'll have a very snappy kick, but then they'll also have a beefy one, and they combine them so that it sounds like it's all one thing. Do you find that you multi-layer a lot in any of the areas, whether it's kicks or basses or whatever?
Not a lot, but I have done that with kicks, where I'll take a high end from one and a low end from another. It's just fun to experiment with those sort of things. But
when you're doing that, I mean, then are you sending them to the same bus, or are you compressing them differently or together? Are you EQing the hell out of them, or how are you handling it? You know, an example signal path might be, you know, what?
Yeah, I would bus them together. Definitely bus them. I have a drum bus in all my projects, so.
I happen to know that you're working Logic a lot, which seems to be a tremendously interesting program if you want to use, you know, all of those soft synthesizers. I mean, just the sheer quantity of sounds and then the MIDI and editing functions in there are pretty excellent, especially on a composing side, because you don't really have the live band latency concerns that might drive a person over to Pro Tools or something else for letting a live band hear themselves tracking. You really just want all the best composer tools, and Logic seems to be working well for that. Can you? But I know you've been in Cubase, you've been in Digital Performer. What can you tell me about Logic as a platform for the kind of work you do? Because you can compare it to the others.
Well, primarily, I've gotten rid of all my hardware, and now I work solely inside the computer. And, you know, Logic has enabled that. And so I like all that instant recallability, you know, working on old sessions. And,
'cause quite frankly, even though what you're accomplishing with a remix is a particular sub genre of audio engineering, really you're in a digital audio workstation. You're using some of the same plugins that any mix engineer would be using anyway. The tools of your trade are not particularly different, other than you've eliminated a lot of the hardware, which might make sense if you were dealing with live musicians and other kinds of inputs. But if you're, if you're doing programming along to a vocal that was already recorded through excellent hardware, then you don't, I guess you have eliminated the need for most of that hardware. When I last saw your place, it looked like a perfect like IKEA catalog shot or something with like that modern, maybe Norwegian looking furniture with one clean laptop out and studio speakers and things. It was like, man, it's like he's ready for the photo shoot today, because it was like super like clean and minimalist, but it also made sense that, mentally and otherwise, that you could kind of unwind and be in the space and not be encumbered by gear. Like you could really just
right, no distractions. Basically,
it seemed very
just
nice.
The computer.
But let's get back into Logic. So there you go. So you're diving into Logic, and what features are good or bad about Logic in comparison to the other programs you've used for the kind of remixing you're doing? And do you know, is Logic popular amongst other remixers? Because you've worked with a lot of other remixers, or is everybody just, I mean, I know in the audio world in general, lots of people just kind of go for Pro Tools because it's just so common, but I don't know if it would be any better or worse for what you're trying to do.
Yeah, in my field, Logic is definitely very popular, especially in Europe. Like most of the, you know, dance producers and remixers that I know of use Logic. And I think because, you know, early on, they incorporated all the soft instruments. And, you know, a lot of DJs, remixers, you know, they're on the go a lot. You know, they're DJing in other cities, so they're taking their work with them. So I'd say first and foremost with Logic is the software instruments that you get. All the synths are amazing. The ES2, you know, has limitless potential. And, you know, I've invested quite heavily in plugins, but just what Logic offers out of the box is pretty amazing, and I don't think it even comes close to what anybody else offers. So
I could say I've met you and I've met Charles Dye. And okay, Charles might have a few more plugins than you, but you guys are both plug-in whores.
Yeah.
You know, you guys are two of the worst offenders I've ever met for having every plug-in ever made.
Yeah, well, I'm a bit of a geek when it, you know, comes to all that.
So. Do you, one of the things we were talking about before we sat down is synth patches and just patches in general. Here's a question. This one I don't know off the top of my head. There must be as many or more patch lists traded for these soft synthesizers than there ever were even for the hardware. I mean, it's got to even be more common. Are there communities and places or third-party programmers that are constantly changing the sound of those synthesizers? Is that still something that people are active in? I mean, it used to be the case that with the hardware keyboards, there was third-party programmers that would, well, I go back to when they would sell you the data cassettes to load it in.
Yeah, I'd say there's a few out there. I don't, off the top of my head, you know, I don't really.
Do you just make your own sounds?
Yeah, just make my own sounds. I mean, it's so easy, you know, with the soft instruments. It's just so easy, and then you know, save it, and you always have it. But in Logic, you know, you can save a channel strip setting. So you have your soft, you have your instrument, and then you have your effects and compressors, you know, and you could save that as a channel strip. So a lot of times I find myself, you know, pulling up an old sound that I used, but it's something that I made, and it may just be, I'll take a sound that I've used before, but I just play with the envelope settings, you know. So instead of a pad sound, now it's more of a staccato sound or so.
When you've worked with other remixers, do you find your methods now are more unique to you, or do you think that there's kind of a variety of standard things that all remixers tend to do? In terms of working method.
Methods. There's definitely some standards. And
I got the impression that some of the remixers had a sense that they had to be super protective and super secret of their methods. But, you know, then when you looked at it, really, it was the same shit everybody else was doing. You know, I mean, they're still just,
yeah.
I always thought that people that were super secretive of their methods were just being insecure. Because everybody else is just like, I do it in Logic, but, you know, the Logic isn't what makes it special. It's your ear and your, because in remixing, your taste and your influence, you're really composing so much. You really become a factor in the, you're not just engineering the music, you are creating the music. So it's your taste and your musical sensibilities are really what's the sellable part of this, not whether or not you used a Sony plug-in or something.
Right. I mean, a lot of it is idea-based and in the arrangement.
Because you mentioned you use reverb a lot, but it struck me that in dance music, you don't need to have something that sounds like a realistic hall. You could do anything you want for you, reverb wise or otherwise. It could be anything you imagine. Whereas the convolution verbs, reverbs, stuff like that, they make sense if you're trying to recreate an actual physical space that a band might be in, and you need that naturalness. But naturalness doesn't necessarily apply to what you do.
No, it's not. I'll have a hall reverb that I use sparingly on things, and I'll have a room reverb. A lot on the percussion, I use a lot of short room reverbs on percussion, but I tend to use reverb as an effect more than anything else. I use it to, use it in transitions, and I use the automation to build up, to send more of, I ride the reverb sends, with automation to create more of a dynamic arrangement. And
and you do similar kinds of things with the filtering, right? Because you don't just slap a filter on. I mean, it's something that you're constantly changing, and it moves through the song, and it moves with the song in some way. Are you also doing any weird side chainy? It just seems like there's all sorts of weird stuff you could do with the filters, depending on how freaky you felt about it.
Yeah, I use a lot of filtering. So generally, like in the intro, I'll filter out a lot of the bass so that DJs can mix over top of it. But then throughout the arrangement, I use it to create, those peaks and valleys and transitional effects, on the drums and the bass. I'm always filtering out low end, and then bringing it back in just to create momentum and interest in the track. So, I mean, it's a lot of automation. I generally, when I sit down to arrange, I'll have I'll commit things to audio. And then for the arrangement, it's basically a lot of automation and effects.
That's the one thing I guess I wanted to convey within this interview, because I happen to know it, having known you and having seen your sessions, the level of automation and things affecting other things and changing through the song is astounding. It might be very surprising to somebody who's doing a much more laid back rock or acoustic record that they would never imagine that it would become so complicated. And do you use a lot of multiple busing at all within your mixing or not? I don't know how you deal with busing things at all.
Yeah, I usually just have a drum bus, and I'll even send my bass through that. That's it. And some, reverb sends.
So you don't have, you have very, very little hardware anymore that's not just the computer itself.
Right, just computer.
Do you miss any of that? Or maybe the last time you had hardware, it was implemented in a working method that you would not miss.
Right. That's, I gave it all up for the, ease of it all. So I definitely do miss some aspects of the hardware, but then when I see the potential of the soft synths, it's amazing.
I'm still exciting. Left to wonder whether or not yourself or other remixers would ever look into some of the things that people are constantly fighting in DAWs, like using high-end external reverbs instead of using the machine CPU, because as long as we're legitimately talking about high-end hardware,
right.
A really decent Lexicon or whoever box. Or using external summing or external compressors, I've got an Allen Smart C1, or using some sort of a really nice final compressor on there. I just don't know if having a few select pieces of hardware would ever be seen as advantageous. What about not just yourself, but the other remixers that you've worked with? Are other people as sparse with hardware, or do they also, you know, you? I also won't say their name. I remember their name, but there's a team out in California that you worked with, and mm-hmm. you said that probably the most surprising thing was how they did really incredible remixes, and you went in wondering like what kind of magical gear they had, and it was all like, you know, Mackie mixers and, you know, an Alesis reverb and like super just real average yeah. music store stuff, like pretty.
Yeah, it was a real eye-opener, you know, because I think a lot of times we think we're being held back because we don't have this gear or that gear. And I think, you know, I learned, you know, a long time ago that it's really not the case, you know, and we need to stop feeling like we're being held back and just do it, you know, and, you know, trust your intuition, trust your ears. And, you know, also with technology now, you know, coming down to the masses, you know, everybody can own a computer, everybody can, you know, own a copy of Live or Logic or, you know, any of the number of dolls out there. And, you know, it's just getting the job done these days. And it's probably less about the sound quality, less about the reverb quality, and more about the ideas and, you know, particularly tonality, I would say, is, you know, more important now than the quality.
Could you explain that more so I'm sure I understand what you mean by that? I think I'm tracking you, but...
Yeah, tonality meaning, you know, like how the bass sounds, you know, against the kick, or just sort of like the timbre quality of the sounds that you're using. You know, and of course those are going to be EQ'd, but, you know, they stand out. You know, there's a tonality that sounds good there. And, you know, that could be accomplished, you know, it can, you know, out of the box sort of plugins, EQs.
Do you think you have a greater range of sound possibilities because of soft synths instead of the hardware synths?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Definitely.
Because, you know, as I look at these the keyboards I have now, we're sitting next to like 14 keyboards. Mm-hmm. As I'm looking over at them, I can really, as I just even to look at them, each look different one I look at, I can immediately imagine what its core personality mm-hmm. is. Like I look at the Prophet and I look at the ESQ-1 or I look at the Jupiter and like I go like I know what its core nature is. And you can have sounds that exist within its nature, but each one has its zone and mm-hmm. they're specific because they're hardware. And it doesn't seem like that. Because the soft synths aren't hardware, it seems like their range of potentials could be much wider.
Yeah, and also the ability just to add more plugins, you know, inserts and onto it, and then yeah, I mean that's sort of limitless there. And then you could shut it down and come back to it the next day, and it still
and
sounds exactly
truly
the same.
Identical. Do you think that repeatability and to some degree portability is a big factor in how you're working now?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah.
Do you work at a lot of other studios or do you almost always just work in your own space?
Occasionally other studios, but mostly in my own space.
You came from that environment.
Yeah.
Do you prefer to work alone? I got the impression you did.
Definitely. Alone, yeah, because, you know, you get in a space, you get in a zone. So.
What do you have to do, or how do you find yourself when you first hear a vocal? What does it take for you to start to figure out what to do or get creative, or what do you do if you get into a rut? I had lunch with you one day, and you were working on a remix, and actually, you told me you were really getting stuck, and you played two possibilities. And the first mm-hmm. one, you said, "Man, I'm really stuck on this," and it I can tell you now, it wasn't that good. But you said, but this is the one I think I like. And it was really a lot better. And that one became the final mix and it became really good.
Yeah.
But I don't know how do you start being inspired and how do you work through ruts? Because clearly people need to be inspired in different ways. And for you, it starts with letting you be left alone to find your way to it instead of getting you hyped up and whatever. For you, it's a more of a quiet exercise. Can you tell me about that?
Well, I definitely spend probably if I have 2 weeks to turn around, I would say that the first week is spent sort of exploring. And, a lot of times I'll try to hear it in my head. Or, after I sit there and listen to the acapella over just a simple beat, I may come up with some ideas or hear something in my head. So it's definitely first week, I work a little and then I'll take a bit of a break, go for a walk or just, get away from it. And that's when ideas will come. But a lot of times when I just sit down and I just go off into a direction, then a couple of days later I start to question it, and with many remixes that I've done, I've started in one direction, then I stopped, I've gone another, and then I've gone back to, the initial one. But, I think, you want it to be the best it can be, and you learn more about the song as you get into it, and you may learn something down the road with the song. Something else about the song might interest you or come to your attention that, you want to
have
make
that,
bigger.
Yeah, have that drive a certain.
Yeah. Well, and also just taking time to step back and consider, what the objective is. Is it dancey enough? Does it have enough energy? Does it make the song sound the best it can be? I like to stick to, stick to the, a lot of remixers will just use like certain vocals or certain parts, or I like to, incorporate the whole song.
Okay, so you avoid just using that one little hooky thing, but you really want to keep more of the nature of it in there.
Yeah.
There's something this is something we talked about before, but I don't think we've said it on mic. I think your mixes sound really good. This is a relevant thing to discuss. It's part of why we're talking together. I think a lot of people, especially people that are very focused on being in the box, like it's also easy to come up with a smaller or flatter mix or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of electronic guys that maybe don't have enough engineering sense or good enough monitoring or something. Where you, on the other hand, you've got very, very good sounding remixes. Tell me about what your process is for comparing your proposed final product against what else is out there to make you arrive at all the balances that you do.
Well, thanks for that. I'm constantly comparing it with other records that I think sound good.
And now I've forgotten the name of that, the plugin you were using to do the frequency comparison.
Yeah. Logic has a plugin called Match EQ. So I'll use that, I'll use it on individual sounds as well as, on the main mix, on the main bus. Just
does the Match EQ show you then also the differential? Like here's where it was and here's what your source was. So here's
just shows me kind of the ballpark. And then I'll go in with another EQ and kind of, fix those areas, but I'll use Match EQ as sort of a guide.
Show you where you're deficient or where you're too
I will. Yeah. Cause I don't have the best mixing room, you know, right now. So.
But you still have totally respectable, you know, I mean, I've mentioned, you know, you got like Dyne Audio acoustic speakers. It's like, they're, you know, it's totally respectable gear. Mm-hmm. But I think your absolute insistence on making sure that the frequencies are right is, well, it's important, and it's the right kind of quality control for your product.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, everything that I do goes to a mastering house. Mm-hmm. So
do you always use the same one, or do you even get to choose?
No, it's the record label does the mastering. So I don't have any input in it at all.
How changed do you think the final mastered mixes are from what you delivered? Are you ever surprised in a good or a bad way?
Well, they're definitely squashed. and, you know, I think I still keep waiting to hear like a mastering that really impresses me. But generally, it's just loud and the low end tends to be a little more solid in the mixes, and you know they sound good on a, you know, on an iPod or in a car or on the radio. So it's never really that big of a difference. You know, I'm always expecting something more.
You talked about how you, sometimes then you'll take the mono dry original vocal when you're just gonna work on a remix, and you'll just throw some beat behind it just to start working. Of course, to my ears as a layman, the first thing that comes to mind is, depending on which beat you throw behind there, I mean, that you're going to affect the whole flavor of everything. You're going to affect the mood and how you're going to affect how you think of that vocal from there on out, for better or for worse. So for starters, how do you even pick that beat, or how much time do you spend picking a beat to put behind there? And then the next question is, do you have your own library then of beats that you're digging through while you're doing this, or where do these beats come from?
Well, I should have been more specific. I'll just start with the kick drum.
Okay.
Because, yeah, you're right, because you don't want the groove of the drums to influence you. Unless I have a really good idea of what I think the groove, you know, should be. But generally just a kick drum, because you know it's going to have the four on the floor. It's sort of a given.
I would assume so, but, you know, I don't want to presume too much. But you have to totally make up. Don't you have to totally make up all the rhythm stuff mm-hmm. yourself? I mean, I would think if you were picking from libraries or using other stuff that it would sound too generic too quickly, and that you wouldn't be able to command your price tag for just turning out generic mixes. I would think that you have to really create that rhythm yourself somehow.
Yeah, plus just throwing in a loop, it's not that fun. It's not that much fun. Although there are a lot of people that work like that, they'll work off loops. But, you know, generally a loop is going to have too much going on in it. It's, you know, it's just going to be too busy, and that's what I find with loops. Also, I want to have some control over the, you know, the swing and the quantize of it.
Do you quantize strictly, or do you move it a lot?
Both, actually. So, in Logic, there's a delay parameter, and you can delay everything or push it ahead or push it back, you know, by milliseconds. And that's fun to play with, because you can really get some interesting grooves with that by just, you know, taking a snare and moving it ahead just a bit or back.
How much of it do you use any sort of loops and sounds, and how much do you just plain program it yourself? I thought you pretty intensely did all the programming, really. You didn't rely very much at all on any other loops or pre-done stuff.
Well, yeah, you're talking about drums, right?
Well, the whole thing, really. But sure, drums in particular, but yeah, but the whole thing. I mean, I don't I mean, I always, in the times I've seen your mixes, you're playing the synth parts and you're playing the drum. You seem to really be doing the programming and not at all leaning on any other kind of libraries, loops, or anything that's very pre-done for you.
Yeah, I tend to program, and I might have a bit of a loop, like, you know, somewhere in the background. It's nice to mix the two, mm-hmm. you know, have most of your drums programmed, and then for a little flavor, you know, I won't use a loop as is, but I'll chop it up a bit and maybe use a couple of the hits out of it.
So that's the stuff you do, and you seem to succeed at it. How about this, though? In music in general, or in remixing in particular, what are the main mistakes that people are making, especially that make things, let's say, like rhythm tracks fall flat, things that don't pack the dance floor? What are people doing wrong so that, because your music brings people to the dance floor. So what are the things people do wrong when they're kind of failing at it? I mean, is it just four on the floor without any movement, or what kind of things?
Well, definitely the mix plays a big part, because on a dance floor, everything's really loud, right? And so if you've got this wall of sound coming through, it's just not going to be very pleasing to people. So you really have to go for real deliberate elements. You know, there's no, like, you know, ducking this little arpeggio way in the background. You know, things are, like, very deliberate. And then you want to give those sounds and parts space, you know, and highlight them. And, you know, just, you don't want clutter. And then the other thing is a kick drum. You know, you really got to feel like a pulse. So, you know, the rhythmic elements are very important. And I suppose the things that people do wrong would be, you know, using loops or layering loops, you know, because like I said, you know, loops tend to be very busy. So you're layering a busy loop with another busy loop. And, you know, your rhythm section is going to be, you know, too thick. So, and of course, you know, the tricks of like side chaining and, you know, really defining, you know, defining all the parts and making them stand through.
Now, let me ask you this. I just finished a job where I was doing sound at a 4,000 seat theater, except like a lot of live sound applications, it happened to be mono. I presume most clubs are stereo, although clubs seem to be very variable about where they put their high frequency cabinets, about mm-hmm. how much subwoofers they have, about if the DJs are even smart at all about running the mixers into the red too much. And no offense to DJs, but they seem to not know a lot about gain staging and why running certain mixer levels or whatever is bad. I mean, can you mix things for stereo? Can you do stereo effects? Or because of the variability, the room placement of the speakers in clubs and stuff, I mean, do stereo effects even work in clubs? Or you know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, I don't know that it'll ping back and forth across the room in any good way. Or if you're just standing in one hot half of the room, you'll only hear that half and you won't really hear the response from the other side and it'll just be stupid.
Well, yeah, but, you know, people are playing these mixes on their iPods and, mm-hmm. you know, on the computers as well. Like I said, you know, a lot of it's available on iTunes. So, yeah, it has to sound really good. It has to have a really nice, you know, stereo image to it.
Does it have to be mono compatible, or do you
Absolutely.
Even know?
Absolutely, yeah.
How do you check for it?
I have a Mackie Big Knob, mm-hmm. and I listen to everything in mono.
Right on.
So, and even when I'm listening to other people's mixes, you know, I listen to it in mono just because I know it has, if it's being played in a club, it has to translate. And, you know, right now, really big bass sounds are popular. Like, you know, bass lines are pretty much dominating the whole track. And it's not a mono bass, you know, it's like a lot of layered bass sounds, and they have a lot of stereo-ness to them. So, I'm always checking it in mono, you know, trying to get a good sounding stereo bass. Usually, you know, you layer it, you keep the low frequency, you know, you layer two different bass sounds. Something has some low into it, and something has a little mid-range to it. And you keep the low sound in the, you know, mono, and then mid frequencies you can really spread out. But
especially with the the bass is fairly omnidirectional. I guess I'm trying to figure out how well that stereo bass stuff would work, because it seems like it still seems like it's flirting with a dangerous idea by the time we're talking about
the
differences in the speaker placement in the clubs, because some of them have just atrocious speaker placement.
Yeah, and the club is, you know, much more forgiving, I guess, because it's going to make everything sound loud. But, you know, when for home listening and you know, iPod listening, you know, you want it to sound really good. You know,
a lot of clubs have, I mean, some of the clubs I've seen, they have like BBE sonic maximizers and other stuff like that hidden in the racks, so that they're even pushing this idea of hyping up the highs and clarifying the lows. Like they're doing certain amounts of processing themselves. I mean, do you find that club processing, whether it's EQs or BBEs or other stuff, I mean, does that at all mess up your mixes, or do you have to mix with that in mind? Because
yeah, you do. Generally, I'm not sure about those maximizers, but you know, they use compressors and then EQs that are tailored to the room. And
do you find that? I would think that those clubs, I think some would be well set up and some not so much. I think it'd be all across the board. I mean, am I correct in assuming that that the systems are set up kind of pretty differently from each other with varying degrees of competency?
Yeah, definitely.
Because how you get it to translate across all of those has got to be one heck of a trick.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and a good club system
can be great.
I mean, it is very expensive, you know, so there's this wide range of price, you know, that you could pay for a club system. But yeah, you have to keep all that in mind, you know.
Let me ask you, here's a side note. Tell me a little bit about your professional history. How does a person start getting remix jobs? I mean, I know people ask that about how do you get started in audio and audio engineering. Geez, and that's just a big open-ended question that could take a while. But you already were involved in writing original music, remixing things for certainly doing hardcore editing for people and stuff. I mean, you had a very, very solid studio when I first met you years ago. But do you have to have an agent? I mean, do you have relationships with labels, or like with whom do you forge the business relationships? How do you make this an actual profession? I mean, like, or at least how did it happen for you?
Well, in my case, you know, I do remixes on my own now, but I've worked for other people. And so I probably have about 10 years of experience with that. But I knew that I wanted to make, you know, dance music. And
do you still go to clubs and stuff a lot just for fun?
A little bit, maybe for research. But
I felt like I outgrew it a little. Like I'm starting to feel a little out of place going to those clubs, or at least the ones that I used to go to.
Right.
But at the same time, if you're making music for those places, I think you'd have to be somewhat involved.
I guess, I mean,
and you got a lot of friends that are DJs still too, right?
Yeah, most of my friends are DJs. But in the early days, you know, I made music for cheerleaders. I did cheerleading mixes, but I wasn't a cheerleader. And then I made, you know, music for aerobics, and I didn't do aerobics. So I just think for some reason I like doing energetic music, and you know, there are a lot of, you know, people out there doing a lot of bootleg remixes. And now with the internet and a lot of that stuff gets around very
some,
easily.
And some are good and some...
Yeah, so, definitely.
There's a variety of quality levels. Some is very good and some not so much.
So I'm not sure exactly what it takes. I mean, I just started giving music to other DJs or producers, remixers, and, you know, somebody just snatched me up, basically, and I was put to work.
So you just, I guess that's the old-fashioned way. You were literally handing mixes to DJs until you had built up a network of people that, but you don't have, let's say, a manager or an agent for yourself?
No. I did enter a remix contest back in the late 90s and ended up winning that. So that sort of gave me the confidence that, yeah, I can do this.
Do a lot of other remixers have agents or managers or whatever to negotiate all the details?
Yeah, I think the ones with the busier schedules, you know, are doing albums and touring a lot. I'm not a DJ myself, so I just work in the studio, so it's all manageable. But I'm sure an agent or a manager could go pretty far in getting deals for you, you know. But
does that mean you? What about you and money? Have you had to figure it out all out on your own? I mean, since there is no agent or manager, you keep it all, so you don't have to give anybody a percentage. But
right.
Have you figured out apparently then how to negotiate a good deal for yourself? Or is that ever a problem that you don't have somebody who's a bulldog fighting for you so you can get to be the nice guy and then they have to be the jerk and fight over the money?
No, nothing like that. No. I have friends, you know, being in this business so long now, you know, I have friends. And so everybody just sort of supports each other. So, you know, I probably got my start through... you know, somebody that I know talking about me or talking me up. Mm-hmm. So, and I think with the A&R guys at these labels that hire the remixes out, you know, if they hear your name from a couple different sources, you know, then they're going to know that you're probably a pretty good person worth checking out. And I think it comes down to there's definitely some trust issues, you know, because your reputation means a lot in this business. So the fact that I, you know, came up through the ranks and I knew these people and I've worked with this person and so forth gave me the credibility, you know, that I needed. But I don't think you could just walk right through the doors and say, hey, I want to do this, you know, because they have to know who they're dealing with.
You have to pay your dues.
Yeah, you do.
Tell me more about what you get. So let's say you're you and Madonna calls or whoever it would be. But you get a call from the people and they want you to remix a current hit. What happens next? Do they give you a DVD? Do you just do a high-speed download? Once you've downloaded it, what do they give you? Tell me everything about that part of the process, about what it actually is.
You mean aside from the negotiation?
Yeah. So let's say the business is done.
Okay.
And you're ready to start the work. You're okay. So you've taken off your office hat and you put on your remixer hat. What do you get?
They'll usually send a Pro Tools session. So the actual session for the song. So you have all the parts. You can pretty much take what you need out.
You've also mentioned sometimes they've sent comped or processed stems, and sometimes they limit what they allow you to get for either through a glitch on their side or from out-and-out paranoia that the music will get out in advance of its release.
Mm-hmm.
So what are those? I mean, in some extremes, you've gotten like every single raw take, probably more than you need.
Yeah.
I mean, haven't you gotten some where there's like 17 different vocal takes and nothing's labeled as the finished one? Or
no, it's pretty much comped by the time you know, that I get it. What I get is what the mix engineer gets generally. Mm-hmm. And that's when you're working with, when I'm like, Island Def Jam, mm-hmm. you know, it's a pretty big record company. So you're most likely going to get like a Pro Tool session. But when I deal with smaller independent labels, you'll probably just get a vocal stem, and hopefully there's a separate background track as well, and it's not all one, so that you can manipulate the tempo as you need to.
I happened to be at your studio when you were working on one, and I noticed that this particular project, again, not naming any names or whatever, but on this project, the thing you were given actually had like reverb. There was actually like, they were very processed vocals. It seemed like that was going to make it a whole lot more difficult for you to work with.
Yeah. That was on Rihanna. So that was just a mistake. So we had to get dry vocals sent.
You didn't even tell me, or didn't say out loud with, you know, clearly Pro Tools sessions is the normal thing delivered, but are they giving you addresses to where they have FTP sites and things like that? Or are people still sending you like DVDs or hard drives? Like, how do you even get the sessions?
The sessions are sent to me on the DVD, you know, usually overnighted. But there have been cases where I just get a file sent to me. You know, if it's a few files, they'll just send them. So if I'm not getting a Pro Tool session, then it's generally just an acapella.
Because I presume we're getting more and more to where some sort of digital delivery methods, whether it's DigiDesign's digital delivery or if it's just protected FTP sites or stuff like that. I mean, I would presume that with high-speed internet, more and more, you wouldn't even need physical media.
No, in fact, you know, when I turn in the final mixes, you know, I post them to my FTP site, and so I eventually may follow up with a disc, but initially everything's just sent off, you know, AIF 24-bit files posted to my FTP site.
But is your relationship more with a label or with an A&R person? Like, who is your business points of contact?
A&R.
Because clearly it's not the artist that necessarily finds you. It would have to be somebody else.
It is independent. You know, I've done remixes for independent artists. So, you know, and right now you've got a lot of independent artists existing. And then you have really small labels, and then you have the big guys. So, and, you know, I've worked on all those levels.
Is any of them more fun than anything else?
It's funny, like the big labels, you know, after I turn it in, they have less to say about it or corrections. But it seems like the more independent stuff, they tend to be a little more picky.
They're more involved?
Yeah, a little more involved in general.
Yeah, I presume that I would have guessed that the independent stuff might be more rewarding, but that the big label stuff probably pays better and helps, certainly helps your resume and all of that. Helps with bragging rights.
Yeah.
Is there a big pay disparity between the two? I suppose there's, you know, people coming at pretty different budgets, so you got to find a way to work that way.
Yeah, it is.
How's the time frame for the turnaround, too?
Well, that's probably the main difference. The bigger label stuff is 2 weeks, but when I work with independents, I usually negotiate a longer time, you know, and it's a lower fee. So, you know, I like balancing it out because on the smaller stuff, I may get to explore things a little bit more, or I might try something a little differently. But I know I have a little more time, so, and, you know, that could be good.
Unlike just mixing tracks, because remixing, because you're so much composing, I guess there's more of a chance that you would turn in a mix that was possibly so different from what they expected that you might have to. If you're turning something, I'm not saying that it's bad, but somehow it's not what they like. Do you negotiate such that you're obligated or to turn in another one, or how much work do you put in to make them happy before you say, all right, if you want me to do another one, you just got to pay me more? Or how do you find a balance between keeping them happy and not getting taken advantage of?
Well, I guess I haven't really run into that.
Well, that's good.
Usually what I've turned in, they've been happy with, you know, so
except
far.
Except for
so.
Maybe minor tweaks or something. You said for the independent guys might want to tweak a little bit.
Yeah.
But you've never had them say, man, that's just too low of BPM or whatever
it
would be.
No, I guess that's why I get hired, because at this point I should know what is needed, you know? So I'm getting paid for my expertise as well as my skill, so. But, you know, I'll do a radio edit. I'll do usually a dub that has less vocals in it. And we might go back and forth on the radio edit, you know, exactly what that should be and how long it should be.
Do you ever test these mixes before you even send it back to the company? Like, have your little DJ friend of yours play it at a club and just watch the floor?
I would think I would do that. I do have my friends play it on the dance floor.
I mean, that's the test.
Yeah, it's the test. And I say I have to ride, you know, the line, a fine line, you know, because you sort of want it to be new and fresh sounding, but at the same time, you know, you want it to be something that people can grasp a hold of, you know, quickly. So, and I think, you know, I found out how to ride that fine line. So,
but with all of this, do you ever feel? Do you still find that this is a good creative outlet for you, or do you ever feel stifled that you have to deliver commercial mixes and you have to use other people's stuff? Do you ever feel a little held back for your own artistic?
Not when I used to. Program and engineer for other people, yeah, it did get to that point. But now that I could just have a vision and go for it all on my own, and that's brought the creativity back into it. So,
here's a funny question. You talk always to the A&R folks. Have you ever gotten any direct feedback then from any of the artists that you've done the remixes for? Or I don't know if you would even ever have contact with them, because you, even though you're all working on the same music, you're just removed from each other enough.
Yeah, it's very rare. It's very rare that I ever talk to the artist.
But I just think it would be really great if whoever, Hillary Duff, anyone would say like, man, that was what a cool dance remix, because I'd never thought of my music that way. But I wonder what they're thinking. And
yeah. Or if they ever hear it. Yeah, no, they've never been in contact with me. Of course, all the smaller independent ones, yeah, you know, they're really happy about it. So I'll get an email or.
You know, for like rock music, a band will come on and I'll go, oh, the Beatles, or, you know, whatever the band is. They become recognizable in every way, in their songs or their sounds. But there's a lot of those, you know. You talk about that music and the whole description is like, oh, some underground European stuff. And I guess the worry is if there's just all these tons of things that despite our best efforts, we wouldn't even be able to know the names of, well, who's making this or what label. I mean, it'd be practically impossible to keep track of it, especially when everybody's trying to be seener than thou and come up with the next weirdest, most underground, most unknown thing. So everybody's trying to be like, almost like that. I'm trying to get my head wrapped around, how does a person making that kind of music come up with a song where they go, hey, that's a Jody Denbroder song. Listen to that. Like, how do you break through to where it fits within the context of that situation, but yet it still seems recognizable on its own right and doesn't blend in so much that it just becomes described as that European bleepy shit that they were playing. Like, I don't know how you make that distinction. How would you approach having your name be a brand, having your remixes be a brand?
I've never really thought about it.
Because you are doing that.
Yeah. I guess for the most part, when I get hired, ultimately they're going to work it to the Billboard dance chart and the Billboard DJs, because there's DJs in every city who report to Billboard, you know, for their chart. It's like top 50, you know, dance club play and dance sales. So, you know, it's a big push to get that remix number one on that chart. So,
and clearly it must be the case that your fees must have been able to creep up, or even more than just creep up, as you've started to, as your remixes have been charting more and more. The more big names you work for, the more chart hits you've had. I mean, that's clearly that should negotiate to better rates for you, I presume.
It does. And even more so if when my remixes get played on the radio, that's also another factor, you know, because actually radio is, you know, having it played on the radio is bigger than having it played in a club. So, and when you can bridge that gap, that's when it's the best. So that's why I say, you know, I kind of ride the fine line.
If there was somebody who was trying to remix, who was listening to you talk, saying like, well, you know, hey, I think I've got talent, but, you know, I just need to figure out how I'm going to get a chance for me to mix Madonna or whoever it would be. I mean,
well, if they're doing, you know, electronic music or dance music, you know, getting that played in a club ultimately is probably going to be best for them. But nowadays there's all these outlets like online for music sales. Beatport.com is one. And
are you affiliated at all with like CD Baby or any of their digital?
No, no, but there's definitely, you know, like Beatport just caters to underground dance music. So it's sort of, and you can get your music on there.
Your stuff is on iTunes, but it's via the artist, not via yourself.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But for up-and-comers, I mean, if it's good, people are going to notice, you know? I think there's a big gap there.
Absolutely. I think people who are doing good work, it'll stand out no matter what gear they're using or anything else. I think the talent that they bring to it will make the difference. Thanks, Jody, for being with us for this interview. So that was Jody Denbroder, high-end remix engineer. He'll be joining us in the forums, and we want to bring your attention to the Our House Remix Forum, a new forum to us here in the womb, where there's discussions about remixing in general, and hopefully Jody in particular will be there to answer questions specific to this interview. So if you are interested in remix engineering, please join us in Our House, which has just recently opened up as a forum for us, and we'll see you there. Thank you very much. I'm Pounce, and this has been Womb Radio. Hey,